Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you had a recent column up at National Review Online entitled Progressive Mass Hysteria. Now, I want to jump into this conversation sort of midway through that column because of a sentence in there that might land funny on the ears of listeners without the proper context. You write there, quoting you, "American democracy has become increasingly Athenian." Okay, so far this may sound like a compliment, but you continue, "as it periodically whips itself up into outbursts of frantic indignation." For people who are not steeped in the classical world, that may land a little uncomfortably because the Cliff's Notes version of ancient Athens is that it was this place of refined, sophisticated democracy. So before we get to the American analog, explain how it also served as an example of what you call frantic indignation.
Well, Athens, as contrasted to Rome, was not representative. In other words, it was direct. So twice a month, people crammed into the Pnyx, and what 51% of the people wanted on any given day, they got. And we have a lot of vivid descriptions in the historian Thucydides and Plato about what that meant. And what it meant was that if anybody got whipped up, they could kill the people on Mytilene one day and the next day think it was a bad idea and decide not to kill them. And the two triremes that were messenger ships would vie to see which vote got there first. And the point is that when our founding fathers looked through classical precedents, they looked at Rome and its tripartite judicial, executive, and legislative representative model and not direct French Revolution type democracy. So what we're seeing now, though, is that we get a particular issue. In this case, it was gay marriage, which both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama ran against in 2008 and Obama again in 2012. And then it becomes politically correct, but to the point that if you're against it, you can lose your job, you can be demonized, you're considered a homophobe. And then that popular outrage, it gets through the internet, it gets on social media, and it's not enough to say that it's an alternative or civil unions are fine. It just becomes the law of the land, the cultural law of the land, and the Supreme Court then reacts to popular pressure, and we've never had a legislative discussion of it. Nobody's ever said should it be left to the states or anything. It morphs from a grassroots explosive idea into a Supreme Court decision, and then bam, that's it. And what I was getting at is that on these issues like that, and sanctuary cities, illegal immigration, they have been the same thing. One day I woke up as a syndicated columnist and I was using illegal alien. The next day I woke up and it had to be illegal document. And the next day I woke up, it had to be undocumented immigrant. And so we get these peer pressure, mass hysteria, whatever it is. It's not enough to disagree with somebody. We have to destroy them, and we have to have instantaneous results. And that's pretty much where we're at now on all of these very explosive social issues.
And with identity politics, I mean, you mentioned in this column, as you mentioned here, now the slightest hesitation about gay marriage can be chalked up to homophobia, or the slightest misgiving about illegal immigration is taken as evidence of xenophobia in ways that would be unimaginable just a couple of years ago. I think you can already see this beginning to happen with the area of transsexuality as well. The question for you there, Victor, is there any sort of inherent breaking mechanism on this? Here's what I mean. The traditional notion is that America is always capable of social change, but that it tends to be slow, that that's what it means to live in a deliberative democracy, that sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, we tend to be slow to upend these mores. But this all seems to be moving at a breakneck speed these days.
It is. And we have to look for historical precedents. And we see the locus classicus of all this in Athens. There was a way to break it. In the second book of the history of Thucydides, Pericles said he wasn't going to be swayed by the mob, and they actually tried to fine him and do all sorts of bad things to him when they blamed him for enacting what they wanted, i.e. to go to war. And Thucydides gives him an encomium and said that he was not led by the mob. He braked it. And the same thing was true of Socrates, even though they ended up killing him in a popular court because they were angry that some relatives of him and students were anti-democratic. So there are certain people where they're distasteful. I'm not saying Donald Trump is Socrates, but he's getting a lot of admiration, not because he's a sober and judicious thinker. It's because he says, stop it. I'm going to say this, and here's what I said. And if you don't like it, that's tough, but I'm not going to back off. And I was watching Fox News the other night, and Rick Perry got on, and he reflected this. He said, this mob mentality, he said, Trump said what he said was uncouth, and I'm against it, and I don't like demonizing people. And then Sean Hannity showed prior clips where Perry himself had cited rapes, murders, astronomical crime rates in Texas. I don't know what it was, 350,000 illegal aliens now are wanted on criminal indictments that they've paroled and they have not shown up for probation hearings, etc. And all these statistics were pretty depressing. And then he just looked like a deer in the headlights. And then he was asked, well, what do you object to? He said, well, I object to, he said this and this. And he didn't think it through. He just got on this mob mentality that Trump is bad and I don't want to demonize people. But he didn't look what Trump had actually said, which was uncouth and crass, but it was not necessarily empirically that outrageous. And yet Perry thought, I'm going to get into the crowd of damning Donald Trump, even though he said things that I used to embrace when I wasn't a candidate. And you're starting to see this, you know, one day Paula Deen is good, one day Paula Deen is awful. One day Donald Sterling is a magnificent businessman who brought back this defunct basketball team. The next thing, we're going to take it away from him, and he's public enemy number one. He may be, but he's also, you know, he has a right to be biased and racist and prejudiced in his own private life. And if somebody illegally taps one of his phones, I mean, there's certain things we have to take in consideration. Just because we don't like him or we don't like what he represents doesn't mean we have to demonize him and destroy him. That's what I'm getting at.
Let's talk a little about another recent example of the mob mentality, which is the controversy over the Confederate flag that arose in the aftermath of the shooting in Charleston. Because I know you think the judgment about what to do with the flag is distinct from some of the things that subsequently happened in civil society. Explain that.
Well, I have no problem with, and I never, as a Northerner, I never have any sympathy for a state sanctioning that flag. We got to remember that after the Civil War, and during Reconstruction, the stars and bars disappeared from most of the state flags. They came back. I think there's still four with them. They came back in the 20s as a symbol of white resistance to integration and Klan, etc. So I don't think the states have subsidized that. But that's a very different question than taking that principled stand after this racist shooting in Charleston, and then making it into a witch hunt in which we Trotskyize American history, and we say that, you know, anybody that has a Dukes of Hazzard has a Stars and Bars flag, therefore get it out. Gone with the Wind, let's not play it anymore. Confederate battle monuments, let's not do that. And where do you stop? And the answer is it's selective. It's very selective. I mean, I could say things about Malcolm X that are terrible and happen to be true. Do we say we're not going to watch Malcolm X, Spike Lee's movie, which was completely dishonest? And do we go back to the past and we say, you know what, I like Ken Burns, The Civil War, but I can't watch it anymore because there's nice music, violin music, when they talk about Longstreet, they have the Stars and Bars. I don't like Shelby Foote trying to contextualize the South, therefore let's just get rid of it. And the answer, of course, is we don't do that because Ken Burns is seen as a liberal, caring person. Nobody in the left is saying, let's go back and rename all the schools, one in my hometown, that have the name Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was the biggest racist of the 20th century, probably the only unapologetic racist. He opposed John Pershing's integration of troops in World War I. He, as president of Princeton, insisted that no blacks could be admitted. He was just an awful guy in that sense. But the left sees him as an internationalist that believed in United Nations, League of Nations type ideas. And they're not going to go back and say, let's rename schools that have Wilson, or let's not take the Princeton School of International Studies and get rid of the Wilson name. So what I'm getting at are two things. One is this mob mentality that gets whipped up and then looks for victims, almost like a rabid dog is looking for someone. And then the second is that it's selective. It's a method that the left uses to go after its enemies. They surely don't like it right now that we're starting to get a little hysteria about illegal immigration after these horrific series of murders and accidents where Donald Trump brought to our attention the criminality that's very common among illegal immigrants. People dismissed him, and then suddenly these horrific cases came to light, and now suddenly you can't find anybody who was for a sanctuary city, and the left is starting to say, well, this isn't fair. I mean, this wasn't really what I meant by sanctuary cities. And you want to say to them, well, when you go with a mob and you uncorked it so many times, what do you expect? But usually it's selective, and the left is not even handed on going back and getting rid of symbols of supposed race, class, and gender oppression in the past.
Victor, I know that every generation seems to fear that it's the one that's produced the technology that's going to be our undoing, but there is something distinct, isn't there, about living in an age of the 24-hour news cycle and social media where if you want to gin up a mob, you can do it pretty quickly and you can do it before most people ever think twice about why they've lit the torches. Does that, you think, end up changing the face of our democracy in a meaningful way?
Well, it does in two ways. I mean, one is, of course, the technology. The technology is like a pump, though. It's just a method to deliver ideas more quickly. It's like saying, on my farm, I have a bigger pump now, and therefore the water is different. It just delivered faster, but the water remains the same. The problem that I have is that we are confusing the pump with the water. So we're having millions of young people who we see on the streets or in their cars that are texting on the internet, and we have school administrators that want to give everybody an iPad free, and we consider the ability to use these things with the transmission of actual knowledge or ideas, and they're separate things. So we have people who are more wired than ever before, but they're spending 2, 3, 4 hours a day in social media or talking to each other, and they're not reading, they're not getting classical approaches to learning. They don't know much about grammar. They know nothing of history. There's whole many industries on television of interviewing the average American who can't tell the difference between Jefferson and Washington or Lincoln. So what we have are the worst of both worlds. We have this technology that unites everybody instantaneously and transmits these ideas quickly, or I shouldn't say quickly, instantly, and they come at the expense of education, and they come at the expense of a distinction. So people think, well, I know all about how to use my iPhone, therefore I'm smart, or I can call Nigeria tomorrow, therefore I'm a sophisticated 21st century person. The answer is no. All you're doing is communicating ignorance at warp speed, and that's not knowledge.
So final question then. Does this outrage culture sort of eat itself at some point? There's a trend, for instance, of late with fairly liberal comedians saying they don't want to play college campuses anymore because they're so severe in their political correctness. At a certain point, does the sheer joylessness of this crusade just cause it to flame out amongst the broader public?
Well, it does create heroes, doesn't it? When you have people like Jerry Seinfeld or Donald Trump or once in a while Bill Maher or even liberal hatchet men like Chris Matthews saying a few things that they're getting tired of this, you start to see that there used to be a concept called the silent majority, and I think it's still there. I really do, because sophisticated polling is still pretty accurate, and you start looking at public opinion on issues like illegal immigration, legalization of drugs, deficit spending, food stamps. It's not that necessarily as liberal a country as we're led to believe. So there's a lot of people who watch this And they're sort of like the Roman Empire, citizens of the Roman Empire. We know about the cities and the Satyricon and Suetonius, and it's all sophisticated. There's all this transgendered stuff in Roman imperial literature. There's all this sophisticated emphasis on eating and luxury and fashion and cross-dressing. But there's millions of people in the Roman Empire out in the country that don't know anything about it, or they don't like it. And they keep the empire going for 400 years, but we don't see them. And we can leave. I'm in my office here at Stanford, and I could easily, you know, in an hour and a half, get out in rural San Benito County, and people there will have a very different attitude than Silicon Valley. And I think they outnumber them, actually, nationwide. So this is going to be very interesting because Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party, is going to try to suggest that these issues are going to be hot-button issues, illegal immigration, gay marriage, et cetera. We're going to try to pin people as enemies of progress, obstacles to progressive thought. And I don't think there's going to be a grassroots support there, and there's going to be a backlash. At least Trump has gone from nowhere to, I don't know, third in the polls. It won't last. It'll be like the Perot phenomenon. But nevertheless, it shows you that people are desperately eager for someone to say stop, and you're not going to intimidate me, and I'm going to make fun of you. I'm not going to listen to you tell me what I have to do and what I have to say and what I have to think.
All right. That's this week's show. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist Podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org, where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.